Now, on the BBC World Service, we will retrace a journey, a fictional journey embedded in the true life hardship of America nearly a century ago. 75 years ago, the American author John Steinbeck published what was to become his most celebrated novel, The Grapes of Wrath. At the center of the book is the story of the Joads, family farmers from Oklahoma in America's Midwest. Their farmland has turned to dust, and their farm has been repossessed. Faced with destitution, they, like many others in the 1930s, make the epic journey from Oklahoma to California in search of work and a better life. Along the way, they are victims of prejudice and face exploitation at the hands of unscrupulous employers. The book was an overnight success, and for many became the parable of America's experience of the Great Depression. But it was also controversial, with its critics seeing it as little more than thinly disguised left-wing propaganda. The BBC's North America editor, Mark Mardell, has retraced the Joads' journey to explore the relevance of the book's themes in today's America.
Tom Joad got out of the old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come walking down the road, poor boy, Tom Joad.
Woody Guthrie, celebrating the opening moment of the novel as Tom Joad arrives home to Sallisaw to find the family farm devastated and derelict, Oklahoma turned into a dust bowl. Now the town's problem is not parched, tortured earth, or indeed today's seemingly endless rain. These four horses, splashing around in a muddy training circle, do, however, point to current woes. This used to be a race course, and its closure hit Sallisaw hard. I find Rodney Martin and Aaron Leaf still working in the stables. You can almost hear the echo of the voice of Tom Joad in their despair at America's economy.
My honest opinion, I think it sucks. I mean, I really do. Everything's going up, except for pay. You know, milk's what? $5 a gallon, you know, and here you are working for minimum wage for $7 an hour, you know, so 1 hour's work, you get 1 gallon of milk.
The minimum wage hasn't gone up in 20 years, but everything else has.
Yeah. And whose fault is that? Who do you blame for that?
Governor, president, whoever's in charge of it. They need to change it and change it quick.
What do you think of the president?
I think he's horrible. I really do.
Why's that?
He ain't done a damn thing he said he was going to do. He ain't doing anything to help us. He's helping the oil tycoons and people like that. That's it.
Every president helps him. I mean,
the big guys.
The rich people.
The Grapes of Wrath, which is set in this town, I mean, the guy who wrote it, Steinbeck, sort of very much blames the banks. He sees the bankers as a sort of faceless monsters who crush the working man. What do you think about banks these days?
I don't use them. If I ain't got the cash, I don't need it.
They're just out to take your money. I mean, they charge you for a checking account. They charge you to put your money in there. They charge you to get money out. Steadily take your money.
The Grapes of Wrath. 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 The Grapes of Wrath.
As sales skyrocket, The Grapes of Wrath becomes the book of the nation. Everyone, everywhere, joins in the discussion of its vital problems.
When Grapes of Wrath, or Wrath if you're speaking American, was published in 1939, controversy swirled around it as thick as any dust storm. It was branded red propaganda, burned in some places. One congressman called it a damnable lie, a black infernal creation of a twisted, distorted mind. But it was also hugely successful. I'm unsure whether that's because of the strength of the characters and story overcoming the rather preachy agitprop, or whether this struggle of the poor and downtrodden spoke to its time and beyond. At any rate, it's safe to say here in Sallisaw, Steinbeck is not their favourite author.
Every man in the bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. I tell you, it's a monster. Men made it, but they can't control it.
Steinbeck's view is not shared by Sinclair Armstrong, owner of the only bank in the area, which his father set up in the 30s.
In the Depression, people would come in on a daily basis to see if the bank was solvent. And my dad would take the money out of the vault and he would stack it in a bushel basket, and so that he couldn't necessarily see what denomination it was, but you could see that there was a bushel basket of money there. Who knows how much padding was under the bottom, knowing my dad. But
so he might have helped it out a little bit.
He was a pretty shrewd guy.
But you don't think people like him, or him himself, your father himself, were to blame for those people getting driven off the land?
Well, I swear to God, and I can verify this with many, many people, that my dad was acknowledged to be a really nice man and helped a lot of people. And I can tell you where he helped people that he didn't have to help.
Now, of course, things change, but some things don't. And just as Steinbeck saw the banks as monsters, so some people in the recent recession have blamed the banks. You're a banker. What do you think of that?
The small banks that service the small towns in America take care of the more of the have-nots than the haves. All this legislation to save the big banks has done nothing but hamstring the people taking care of the real population out there, the working class of people.
But do you think it was right to save the big banks?
Well, I think we were in a situation that was unknown to us and hadn't been revisited since the Great Depression. And obviously, only history will determine whether it was accurate or inaccurate. If you'd said, would I have made the same decision, I'm not sure I would have supported what they did. But what they did, in some people's eyes, was helpful. In some eyes, it was wrong. I can tell you that the legislation that came out of that from the Congress was an overreaction as it harmed the small communities and the small banks, and that's why you see the attrition in the small banks and not significantly much in the larger banks.
Dolly Farris, 19 next year, lived here during the time the novel's set and remembers the Depression for one thing.
Hunger. We had 7 kids in the family. We lived in a little log house.
What did you have to eat every day?
Well, anything. The government came by now and then and left us frozen food, goats, which we didn't know how to fix. My mom had never seen a goat, and a lamb, which she didn't know how to fix, so she boiled it. And we had a lot of, like, wild food, wild onions, wild greens, wild grapes, and she was very good about making food for us.
So were you always hungry?
Well, mostly.
So you've seen a lot of history in your 90 years, a lot of presidents. How do you think this president has done, President Obama?
Well, I hate to say this, but I voted for Obama. I think he had good ideas, and it just doesn't trickle down.
You're disappointed in him, would
yes,
you say?
Yes, I am.
Earl Strebeck went to California as a child and thinks Steinbeck created stereotypes that lived on for years.
I lived in California for a little while with my mother. I went out and spent about 6 months with her one time, and I went to school there for a while. And when someone would ask me where I was from, I would say Oklahoma. I'd say, oh, you're an Okie, you know, in a kind of a slurring, joking way, which I resented. And I said, no, I'm not an Okie. I'm from Oklahoma. I'm an Oklahoman. And this is the first time I've ever been to California. And I wanted to say also it'll be my last time, and it was. It was a put down, I thought. And I thought that came directly from the book.
The book describes that, describes the Jodes being called Okies, being dismissed because they're from Oklahoma. I mean, wasn't that just a reflection of the way it was, the truth?
I think it was an exaggeration, I said, of the negative things that was going on here. I always thought the people that stayed in Salisaw, that they were the ones that stayed and toughed it out and saw the Depression through. The people that left here were kind of harum-scarum. They didn't want to work. For the most part, they just wanted to get on the road and go try somewhere else. And we still have those kind of people here. And you can see that happening quite a bit. They give up real fast, take off somewhere else, and fail there. And many of these people that went to California came back.
This is, of course, where the Jodes began their epic journey, and I'm glad to say I've got a better set of wheels than them. They set off in a battered Hudson truck. 3 generations of Jodes, including Tom, who's killed a man and will kill another, but is the caring soul of the book. Cantankerous Grandad, Ma, the Citadel of Strength, pregnant, weepy Rose of Sharon, Uncle John, haunted by sin, the preacher who's lost his faith in God, but not man. And to top it all, literally, on top of the truck, the dog.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters.
Next stop, Akima, home to Woody Guthrie, the radical who wrote this song, almost the American left's alternative national anthem.
I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless sky.
He lived like a hobo and travelled with the fruit tramps, the men and women who, like the Joads, went to California looking for work in the fields and orchards.
This land was made for you and me.
That's what he looked like as a boy.
Very sweet little boy.
Yeah.
And then if you Ron Gott runs the local museum and admires Woody, but doesn't exactly share his politics.
I go back to my years as growing up in the 50s and 60s, and to me that was a good time. People prospered, people worked for a living, and now people set their hands out. And that's what's wrong with our country today. There's givers and there's takers, and we've got a lot of takers in this country. And we have people that work on one side, and we've got people that don't work on the other side.
Are there still people, do you think, like those that Woody sung about, that are like her in The Grapes of Wrath, who are desperately looking for work, aren't getting enough money, are being punished, you know, by the banks and the big corporations? I mean, that's what those songs and that book is about.
No, that's not true today, because the people that's complaining that they're not getting enough are too lazy to go to work because they've been holding their hands out too long.
You hear that sort of view much more often in Obama's America than anything reflecting Woody's radicalism. Let's keep traveling west, towards the dream.
And then the dispossessed were drawn west. They streamed over the mountains, hungry and restless, scurrying to find work to do, like ants scurrying for work, for food.
I'm driving across the desert and I'm just about to cross into California. The Joads made the journey at night because of the heat. They didn't have air conditioning, because we do, and all the cars on this road now can make the journey with hopefully no problem. And I've just passed a sign with a variety of ethnic faces with the slogan, "We weren't born in California, California was born in us." The Joads didn't get that sort of welcome. This is where they really started encountering hostility for being migrants seeking cheap work, people from another place.
Well, Okie used to mean you was from Oklahoma. Now it means you're a dirty son of a bitch. Okie means you're scum. You don't mean nothing itself, it's the way they say it.
Barstow was the first place in California the Joads stopped, and here I find Sylvia Pyle. In her 80s, she remembers the internal migration of the tired, poor, huddled masses.
I can remember that these people with no money and all these kids, and they were tired and dirty and came across this road, and they were considered a threat to California.
What did people say?
They take up space, they don't have any capital, they're poor, and very much like we yell about immigrants now.
And also here in this desiccated desert town, Ruben Arredondo. His dad was a railman from Mexico. He was born in LA in the 30s. The migrants came off the trains 100 feet from his front door and found help from his mother.
And if there were just two or three get off the train, she'd make them a burrito, bean burrito, cheese burrito, whatever she had. And if she gave them a cup of coffee, they were really happy. They'd thank her about 10 times. Seems to me that the poorer the people, I think they're more sympathetic and more human to their fellow man, because they're already there in that stage themselves.
Steinbeck would love that sentiment, and perhaps his next one. Now it's not the Okies who work in the fields and get called names, it's Mexicans, particularly those who cross the border surreptitiously without papers, and one of the names for them is illegals.
Oh, we were talking the other day, we have a cup of coffee, we had four or five guys we just meet there, and this guy was saying a couple of times, well, that's the illegals that are costing us in California, you know, there's just too many illegals. And then I said, technically we're all illegals in this continent. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, we all came here from other places in the world, from Europe and so forth and so on. It's the Native Americans, they didn't give us permission here to stay here. So we're illegals, really.
Over by Weed Patch, we got nice baths and you wash kids in a tub and there's water right handy, good drinking water. Ma said, I sure could use a wash tub, I tell you.
I've left the desert behind now. I've just driven through a really verdant area where there are orange trees, grapes, green peppers, garlic. You think of it and it's growing here. But I'm in a camp that meant a lot to the Jodes out of the Grapes of Wrath. This is the camp at Weed Patch, and when they arrive here, it's like a little corner of government-sponsored heaven. They discover flush toilets for the first time, and there's still standing, just in the corner here, an old tin shack of the sort they'd have lived in. Unvarnished, unpainted, just tin.
Yeah, and imagine, well, you've seen this 106. It's going to get, yesterday was 109.
Linda Haggerty is a teacher who grew up here in the Central Valley and is passionate about the rights of migrant workers. As we talk, a man comes up to us. He's helping restore these shacks for posterity. But for him, they aren't just history. They used to be home.
We had two of these side by side, and there were six of us. And the only way you could cool them, these flaps open up on each side, and we would put a sprinkler, water sprinkler, up on top, and it would come down and the wind would blow through and it would kind of cool it.
Kind of,
as much as possible, you know.
Jerry Gibson's family came here in the 40s when he was just two.
My dad was a sharecropper in Oklahoma, and many times his crops would be ruined. We would have nothing. We had an uncle that was a contractor. He would come out here and work. He told my parents there's a lot of work in California, so we came out here, and my dad started working on a farm, worked there until he retired.
This camp is still home to migrant workers. There are rows of nice, neat bungalows underneath the shade of trees.
These people right here who are coming out their doors, yeah, they're all undocumented. A lot of them are undocumented.
We've gone through a recession. Times are tough. Unemployment is relatively high. Why aren't these places filled with Americans picking in the fields?
Good question. And the thing is if you talk to a farm laborer, they're proud of what they do. They do it well, and they do it fast, and they do it cheap, and they love it. They love that the fact that they can do it better than anybody.
And you obviously feel that they get a raw deal.
Oh, yeah. Well, I grew up in the middle of a golf course in the fields, and I got to hear the growers, and I saw the growers, and then I worked, and I also played with the kids of the farm laborers. A lot of the growers, this is what I heard from growers, Beaners, Spics, Mexican, wetbacks. Didn't sit well with me. If you go to Mexico, what's going on in Mexico? All the places there, the violence there. And as a teacher, I see it in my classroom. Why are you here? Well, I saw my dad get shot and killed, so they came here. I'm a mom, and guess what? I'm gonna go and take my kids and do whatever I need to do to protect my kids. And for people to demonize our farm laborers, that's not the thing. Most of these people are here to find a better life.
It's the same thing today as when we came out here, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, we were looked at as backward Okies, you know, when we came out here.
Leonardo is very typical of millions of people in the States. He was brought to the US by his mum when he was three. Now in his 20s, he has no papers. He risks arrest and deportation to a country he doesn't remember every time he drives. But he thinks his mother did nothing wrong.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You talk to anybody and they'll say, well, they can do it the right way. Well, what is the right way? What is the right way? I talked to a priest once and he said, well, I came here the right way. And I said, how was that? And he said, on a scholarship. And I said, that's the right way? I don't think so.
But he surprises me when he talks of some fellow illegal immigrants who won't learn English.
Sorry to use this word, but they're ignorant. They want to do things their way. And when I speak to some of my family members or people that they know, I think, wow, you're very ignorant.
And you don't like that, actually.
I don't like that. If you're here, this country is changing, I mean, as we speak. And if you're not ready for change, then you obviously don't need to be here yourself, you know?
Lorena, herself brought here illegally as a child, thinks Obama has been a mixed blessing.
The only reason why I'm able to have a license right now is because of an executive order that President Obama did, which provided temporary legal status for undocumented youth like myself after they meet like this long list of requirements. It was a great first step, but we also realized that by the time his presidency ends, he will be responsible for over 2 million deportations. And not everybody that gets deported, they're criminals. They're people like myself. They're people like my mom, my dad, my aunt, my uncle, who work hard and who provide a lot for these communities. communities.
But doesn't something have to be sorted out some way that you can understand a country not wanting people to come in illegally and stay here, and yet, as you say, they need the labor, they use the labor?
Not only with immigration, but perhaps with many other social justice issues, there needs to be greater acceptance of others.
And it seems to me, in the 5 years that I've been here and watching the Obama presidency, that hasn't got better. I mean, when he was elected, everybody was saying it was a great coming together. He talked about not Republicans or Democrats, but everybody together. That just hasn't happened, has it?
He was obviously our first black president. And so people thought, like, oh, you know, this is a huge achievement, which it was, considering what happened during the civil rights movement, right? All the violence towards African Americans and minorities. But there is still a lot of progress that needs to be done in terms of racial justice or racial inclusivity. And not only is true for politics, but also for the education system, the incarceration system, which imprisons so many African Americans, but also so many communities of color.
A local band, the Fruit Tramps, keeping the memories alive. I don't know what Obama thinks of Grapes of Wrath, but he's listed In Dubious Battle, Steinbeck's first published novel, as a significant influence. It's the story of communists orchestrating a strike in California's apple orchards. Unions are the human heroes, growers the impersonal villains. But amid the neat rows of nectarine trees, property of Guerrouan Farming Incorporated, the biggest company in the valley today, I hear a very different story. The pickers, tough, wiry, sunburnished Latino men, judiciously push aside branches looking for ripe red fruit, putting them delicately into white plastic buckets. The company boss, Dan Guerrouan, says he pays top wages and is on their side. He's engaged in a battle with a union, which says it has the legal right to representation. He sees them as the faceless bullies.
You've got a union that's lost 90% of its membership. Their expenses exceed their income by $1 million. And suddenly they decide to come back after a 20-year absence, 20 years of no letter, no phone call, no fax, no email, nothing, and say they're ready to negotiate. And they also said at that time that they are going to force the industry's highest paid employees to give 3% of their pay to that union or fire them.
There's an image that the corporations have been harsh on the workers. Mm-hmm. Is that just a myth? Is that just something that's been created by people for whatever reason, whether it's to create a good novel or whether it's for political reasons? Or has there been some truth in that that maybe now has changed? I mean,
the image that might persist out there, I think, is far from the reality. And our industry is not a PR machine. We're in the fruit business. And it's very difficult to overcome, as we've learned recently, a lot of the PR that is generated by those who try to portray employers in this industry as these evil corporations. We're not.
You're a very successful business person. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this country has been through a hard time with the recession. Mm-hmm. As the president came in, how do you think he's done?
Poorly. I think he's done poorly. I think it's unquestionably he's done poorly. The industry, specifically, is very concerned about his not having done immigration reform, which he promised, and which he was never serious about. He appears somewhat serious about it now, but certainly wasn't previously. He could have had it done had he wanted to. But no, I would say he's done poorly.
So you'd like amnesty or something like that?
I'm not saying amnesty. There are different types of proposals, but some type of immigration reform, I think, is justified.
Why are you so keen on getting immigration reform?
Shortage of labor in this industry. I mean, as you can see, it's very labor intensive, and this isn't going to be mechanized in our lifetime. You can't mechanize the harvest and cultivation of fresh fruits. So it's going to be hand labor always, and that's becoming more and more difficult to find people willing to do this work.
But there's high unemployment still. Mm-hmm. We're in an area that sounds pretty depressed.
And we're paying significantly higher wages than a lot of industries, but you're not going to find those people coming out to the fields to work. And, you know, back in the day, you would come out here and you would see, if the schools are out, you would see high school kids. You would see kids who go to college during their summers harvesting fruit. I worked in the fields when I was a kid. Zero now. None. It just doesn't happen. And you'll find people going for jobs that pay far less, and they're just not going to do field work. So we rely on immigrant labor, and that's becoming harder and harder to find.
One of the pickers, Javier, interrupts.
This is the best place to work right here.
Why is it the best place to work?
I don't feel good.
Do you want the unions in here?
No, I didn't like union right here.
Why?
They take my 3%.
They take your money?
Yeah, they don't want to give them my money.
It's fitting that I should end my journey surrounded by heavily laden, bountiful trees. The windfall is a little bit too crisp for my taste. Grandpa Jode fantasizes about picking fruit off the trees and squashing grapes on his face until they dribble off his chin. Poor guy, he dies before they even leave Oklahoma. The novel's like that. A relentless tale of hopes crushed, dreams denied, but throughout it too a defiant optimism that one day, a distant day, things will be better. Obama's attitude to his own presidency reminds me of that, full of disappointments, and his own conviction that he's laying a foundation for the day the arc of history bends towards justice. But the novel's also a reminder that the conundrums of the 30s, the banks, depression, migration, hostility, like the poor, are always with us, and the grapes of wrath have yet to be harvested.
Grapes of Wrath Revisited was presented by the BBC's North America editor Mark Mardell. It was his final assignment for the BBC from the United States. The producer was Charlie Bell.